Genesis 29. When you get to this point in Genesis, it begins to look similar to afternoon TV, Days of Our Lives, All My Children. I mean, it definitely starts taking on fringe reality TV show stuff. So we do have a lot of ground to cover, and it's interesting reading, difficult stuff to talk about. We left Jacob sleeping on a pile of rocks in the middle of nowhere, wakes up because he's had this dream. And, you know, Isaac sends him off with a promise, and God in that dream gives him a promise, but Jacob, he is still living life on his own terms. God gives him a promise, and he tries to turn it into a deal. And so today, we're going to find out that with all the wheeling and dealing that Jacob is used to doing, he's finally going to meet his match in mom's brother, Laban. And if he thought mom was sneaky, she learned everything from Laban, okay? Because this guy, he is a piece of work. Now, Jesus stated, and I don't remember which gospel it is, I think it's Matthew, but he says, "For all that take up the sword shall perish with the sword." We usually phrase it like this, "He who lives by the sword will die by the sword." That's kind of a modern rendering of it. But I think sometimes when we say that phrase, we often forget when Jesus said it and who he said it to. The words were spoken to Peter when Peter tried to rescue Jesus from the soldiers who'd come to arrest him. And he lops the guy's ear off. I can tell you, Peter was not aiming for an ear. But he's not a very good swordsman. And the idea was, you're not getting to my Lord. I'm going to take care of it and God's fire will help me, you know. And the problem was not so much that he was trying to trust God to rescue the Lord, but the idea was he was trying to do things his way instead of God's. You remember when Peter, the Lord said, "I'm going to be betrayed, I'm going to die and be crucified." And what did the Lord do? He pulled him aside and he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan," and pulled him aside and explained to him. He said, "These thoughts are not from God, Peter. The thoughts that you have, they are from men. They do not come from God." And so when Peter tries to do this, it's his way, his thoughts, not God's way. And so what it means is this, the idea that they that live by the sword will die by the sword, for all they that take up the sword shall perish with the sword. What it means is that when I do things in my own strength and by my own methods, guess what? There's always someone better out there. There's always someone out there who's going to be better than you, who can take you down. Someone is going to cut through your defenses and take you down if the strength that you're leaning on is your own. And as we see Laban take advantage of Jacob here, Jacob who thinks that he's always got the drop on everybody, when we see Laban take advantage of him, may we realize what we consider personal strengths are weak compared to the Lord, and that trusting him is superior to fighting our own battles. So, Genesis 29, verse 1. "Then Jacob went on his journey, and he came into the land of the people of the east. And he looked, and behold, a well in the field. And lo, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks, and a great stone was upon the well's mouth. And thither were all the flocks gathered, and they rolled the stone from the well's mouth, and watered the sheep, and put the stone again upon the well's mouth in his place. And Jacob said unto them, My brothers, whence be ye, or where are you from? And they said, Of Haran are we. And he said unto them, Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, We know him. Yeah. And he said unto them, Well, is he well? And they said, Oh, he's well. And behold, Rachel his daughter is coming with the sheep. And he said, Lo, it is yet high day. Neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Go water your sheep and then go feed them. But they said, We cannot until all the flocks be gathered together, until they roll the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep. And while he yet spoke with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. Well, Jacob, in the phrase here in verse 1 where it says he went on his journey and came into the land of the people of the east, that encompasses 400 miles of travel. So that's about 3 weeks of sleeping on rocks. 3 weeks, you know, of wondering if he might get to his destination. And explains when he finally gets there, you know, you kind of get the idea, the image of, you know, and behold, he looks around and, a well. You know, he sees this well in a field, and lo, there were three flocks of sheep just all lying around by it. And then Moses gives us commentary. You can remember, Moses is writing this to the people of Israel out in the desert. explaining where they came from, what their beginnings were, why they're where they are. And he sees, it says, or Moses says, for out of that well they watered the flocks, and a great stone was upon the well's mouth, and thither were all the flocks gathered, and they would roll the stone from the well's mouth, and then they'd water the sheep, and they put the stone back again in its place. So Moses explains why the flocks are sitting, they're sleeping, why all the shepherds aren't doing anything, they're resting in preparation to be watered. So verse 4, Jacob gets there, and he says to these guys, my brothers, where are you from? And they said, well, we're from Haran. And so he says, oh, I'm in the right spot. So he says, you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And he said, we know him. We know this guy. Notice there's no, oh, yeah, Laban, good guy, lives down through the valley over there. None of that. Yeah, we know him. That Jacob had to inquire to get further information should have tipped him off that Laban isn't exactly a stand-up guy. So he has to ask the follow-up question, well, is he well? I mean, that was common in that day. One of the first things that you would hear would be a blessing. You would hear some sort of, oh, yeah, Laban, good guy, bless his name, you know, good friend, he's over by the valley. But here's none of that. You'd always greet people with a blessing, but there's none of that. And so he has to fish for information. Well, I mean, is he well? You know, he's, what am I walking into here? Jacob has no clue what kind of situation he's walking into. And that's, oh, yeah, we know him. That's not enough intel to know what to do. This is a guy who wants to know his full surroundings and have control of everything before he does something. And they said, hey, he's well. It's almost implied in there, yeah, he's great at our expense, the lousy cheat. He's fine, yeah, he's well. And they almost kind of like, you know, if you're going to mess with him, keep us out of it. Look, you know, his daughter, she's going to be coming with the sheep, okay? So, you know, don't ask us anything else. And so when Jacob hears that, Jacob's thinking, okay, how do I work this situation? Jacob's a master at controlling his situations. Remember, when mom came to him with the plan, he didn't object to the actual idea. He objected to her method because he didn't think it would work. And so when, with news that Rachel's on her way, he does not want to look unfavorable in a group setting. And the easiest way to govern the situation is to get rid of these guys so he can control the meeting. So look, he says to him, he says, hey, listen, it's the middle of the day, guys. It's not time for the cattle to be gathered together. In other words, to be put back in their pens. It's nowhere near quitting time. Why are you all sitting around not working? His wife said, get your work done and get out of here, because he wants to talk to her alone. He wants to control the situation. And he said, we can't, you know, until all the flocks be gathered together, until they roll the stone from the well's mouth, then we water the sheep. So the idea here is that there's some agreement where they all have to water the sheep together. Now, this is a different well than the one his mother met the servant at when she heard about Isaac needing a wife. There's no mention of drawing water or a trough here. There's just mention of a stone. Some Bedouins, wouldn't construct above ground wells like Rebecca had used, but they would put a massive stone over the hole. And when the stone was removed, the sheep would actually come in and they would water themselves. And so it's possible there was a legal agreement for equal use. And the only way to ensure that everyone got equal water was to do it all at the same time. And so he hears this and he's thinking, okay, I can't get rid of these guys. And while he yet was talking to them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. Now, she was the shepherdess. Now, it's customary in the Bedouin culture for the greatest sheikhs to have their unmarried daughters shepherd their flocks. But oddly enough, it's the younger daughter that's out here and not Leah. Leah would be the oldest unmarried daughter. And the idea is the sheikhs would have their daughters shepherd the flocks, so they would be out there and the guys would see them and they would want to marry them. So the idea is you put the one that's available out there taking care of the flocks so she's on display. So that was just how the greatest sheikhs did it. And the idea is, you know, people would get to see how pretty she was and how resourceful she was, and they would all start bidding for her, and that way you make out well if you're a sheikh. So, pity we don't do it this way anymore. I heard the other day that the average cost of a wedding for parents of a young lady is $32,000. Yeah, like, girl, I'll pay you $3,000 to elope. But as we'll see, now, I said, oddly, it's the younger daughter doing this and not the older one. We know, we're going to find out in a minute, she's not married. But as we'll see shortly, he'd had a hard time marrying her off. So he was showcasing the younger daughter, all the while planning to dupe the would-be husband into marrying Leah. And so as she comes, while he's talking, Jacob realizes, I got to do something. So verse 10, it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, he first sees her, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and he rolled the stone from the well's mouth all by himself. And he watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brethren. And Jacob kissed Rachel, and he lifted up his voice, and he wept. And he told Rachel that he was her father's brother, and that he was Rebekah's son. And so she ran and told her father. The text mentions here in verse 10 that he first sees her, and then a study of her features prove that she's family, because it mentions here that he goes through the family line. It says, it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother. He's recognizing, yep, that's her. Looks just like mom, or similar in a sense. And then his eyes move to the sheep. And then he does the only thing possible to cast him in a positive light and to gain control of the situation. What every man wants to do. Go macho man, right? He comes, throws the stone off, and then he waters all her sheep, and you know, and then he comes over and he gets all, dramatic with her. But he comes over there and he kisses her, and this is not romantically; it's the traditional greeting kiss that's still common in the Middle East, and lifts up his voice and weeps and tells her who he is. Now, as he does this and he lifts off the stone, before she can react to his impressive kindness, he regains control of the situation by getting emotional. Now, having lived the last 3 weeks with rocks for his pillow, I'm sure he was already quite emotional. And it's possible that he fell in love with her at first sight. It's very possible that was the case. But what I find to be interesting is none of that emotion shows up when he quizzed the other shepherds about Laban. He is all business at that point. There's none of this, where are you guys from? Haran. Oh, I found it. Oh, thank you, God. There's none of that. He's like, oh, yeah, how's he doing? He's trying to get the lay of the land. But now all of a sudden she's here, and he puts on all this massive display. His reaction is a bit over the top. It says that he kissed her, the normal greeting, and then he lifted up his voice. The word there means to cry loud. He kisses her on the cheeks, and he's like, oh! Would that work with you, honey? Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to have to try that later. And then it says that he wept. In this tense, it doesn't mean that he just started to sob. It means he started to well up. His eyes started to well up with big crocodile tears. And he started, he's having these mild convulsions inside. So it's, this is this big dramatic display. And he probably grabbed her hand and said, Rachel, I'm your aunt's son, dun dun dun, so she hears all this, and what's got to be going through her mind? It had to be jarring for her. She's just out there to go water her sheep, and she had to have heard the story of how her aunt Rebecca's marriage came about, and it's got to be, he's putting himself in this favorable light. This is all God, just like Isaac. And she, in her mind, one of two things have to be going on. Because either A, she already knows what Dad's plan is, which is to dupe the would-be husband. And so she's, either she's just as complicit and she's thinking, I have to go home and tell Dad because this guy's, we got him hook, line, and sinker. Or if she's not complicit, she's got to be thinking to herself, this is how Aunt Rebecca's found her husband. Maybe this is how I'm going to find my husband. Whatever way it is, I tend to think it was the other way, that she was complicit with her dad, because Rachel's not exactly, there's not a whole lot of redeeming qualities about her when we go through the text. She's an idolater, we're going to learn later on. So she's not a follower of the Lord. And we'll study it. So, but either way, the prospect of this meeting excited her enough to respond exactly as her aunt had. She runs home, leaves the sheep there. And so when she gets there, she tells her father, verse 13, it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, that his nephew, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him. Oh, he lays it on too. and brought him to his house, and he told Laban all these things. Now, when we last saw Laban, we saw a calculating man who took advantage of good opportunities. And while his response is very emotional here, who's to know if it's genuine? Because he's not a very honest person. Now, when Jacob gets there and it mentions he tells him all these things, I don't think he tells him the whole story. I don't think he's like, yeah, I lied to my dad and tricked him into giving me the blessing and pretty much I had to flee from home. I don't think that comes out. I do think he probably said, I'm here to find a bride. I do think he probably told him that part. I'm here to find a bride. Mom and dad sent me here to find one. And so I'm so glad I found you. And of course, Laban's like, me too. So verse 14, and Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh, and he abode with him for the space of a month. Now, remember, Isaac gave Jacob clear instructions to find a wife from Laban's daughters. Laban only had two. So if it wasn't love at first sight, Jacob came to pick Rachel during this month, and the Bible says he did grow to love her, and that was genuine. Maybe the first time in his life that Jacob loved something other than himself, because it blinds him to Laban's setup. A man who's not normally blinded by these things, it blinds him to Laban's setup. And so at the end of a month, Laban says unto Jacob, he says, listen, because you are my brother, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Apparently you've been working around the property and stuff. Should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? Now, rather than treat him like an honored family member, Laban proposes to pay him like a servant under the guise of justice and kindness. But there's also an implication that Jacob needs to earn his keep if he's going to stay. You can't just stay here, Jacob. If you're going to stay here, we need to work out an agreement that you work and I pay your wages. But unknown to Jacob, Laban is cut from the same mold as himself. Put everyone around you in a situation where you can control it for your own benefit. Laban had to know that Jacob would ask for a bride. And Laban had to know at this point what he would really do. Because in verses 16 and 17, his problem is explained. Verse 16. And Laban had two daughters. The name of the first was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And here's the problem. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favored. Now, tender-eyed means to be dull or weak-eyed. It means eyes that are tired or watery. That sounds awful. It does. It sounds awful. You know, you go through the scriptures, you think, this poor woman, she's just horrible, horribly ugly, you know, and none of that's true. This was the common Oriental description for blue eyes. It's that simple. It was the common Oriental description for blue eyes. Now, why is that a problem? Well, deep brown or hazel eyes were considered lively and fiery by the Orientals, and they liked their women that way. So it was regarded as the height of womanly beauty. Thus, Leah was not perceived as well favored by God because he didn't give her the fiery, lively eyes. Now, the word there, beautiful, it means beautiful in shape or form. So when we look here and it says that she had blue eyes, but Rachel was beautiful and well favored. So she had those darker, fiery kind of eyes, but it mentions that she was beautiful. And the indication is that Leah was beautiful. She just had blue eyes and therefore was not considered to be favored by God. Now, I bring that up because beauty is such an interesting term. When you bring up the topic of something, is it beautiful? It's an interesting term because it truly depends upon the person who's giving the label, the person who's giving the assessment. And you know the phrase, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? And there's a reason for it. As such, conceptions of what is beautiful changes with culture and time. And I thought we'd have a little fun. I wanted to share with you, I'm just going to share one because we have a lot going on tonight, but 12th century beauty tips. This is what, if you're a woman, these were the beauty tips for you in the 12th century. The first one, that's the only one I'm going to read because it's kind of funny, is hide your hair. Hide your hair. So if you're a woman in the 12th century and you wanted to be perceived as beautiful, you had to hide your hair. Since hair was considered sexy, leaving your hair unconcealed was only done by uneducated peasants, prostitutes, or children. So if you had your hair and you didn't want to be considered one of those three, You would either wear a hat and tuck it all inside, or a net, or veils. Sometimes these ladies, they would have these things where they have like big, huge pigtails that would go out, and then they would cover them with these bandanas. You can see the pictures of that in the old, you know, some of the old photos and drawings and stuff. Hoods were the norm. But this also meant that the higher the hairline, the better. So many women resorted to potions of quicklime or vinegar to erode their natural hairline. So receding hairlines were in, unlike today. And ladies, that vinegar and quicklime concoction would often take the skin with it. Beauty has always been pain, as my wife tells me. Eyebrows were teased within an inch of their lives. Women didn't wear eyebrows. They didn't have eyebrows. And that was what was considered beautiful. Now, what's my point? Quite simply this. Leah and Rachel were both beautiful. In fact, there is no such thing as a woman who is not beautiful. There is no such thing as a woman who isn't beautiful. Listen, ladies, you just have to find a guy smart enough to realize it. There's no such thing as a woman who isn't beautiful. And for those of you that have found a guy who's smart enough to realize it, believe him. Believe it, okay? You know, I'm not going to go there, but I'd like to sleep in my bed tonight. But stop critiquing yourself, okay? If God wants you to lose weight or take care of yourself better, then please be obedient to Him. But don't let your own critical heart or the critical voice of culture define your beauty. In the words of the king in Song of Solomon, "You are all fair, my love. There is no blemish in you." That's how the Lord sees you. And I venture to say that's how your husband sees you. And let that be enough. Let that be enough for you. If I have one other word for you ladies, I would say this. Do not measure yourself against each other in the beauty category. Life is a strange way of altering our bodies over time. It does. Okay? And therefore, defining yourself by your body is not a good idea. In Proverbs 31, verse 30, and it's a famous verse, you're all familiar with it. It says that beauty is vain, and or charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Did I get it right? Beauty is deceitful. No, charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. There. That word vain, it actually means like a vapor. Beauty is like a vapor, poof. The idea is that it can be gone in a moment. You know, I brought the question up to ladies at times. Said, what if something happened? What if you got sick? Would that mean you weren't beautiful anymore? What if you couldn't be the wife that you want to be? Does that mean you're not beautiful anymore? 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 through 4. You can write it down and study it. I think it's meaningful. In our culture, we don't want to hear it. But it's very meaningful because it gets to the crux of the problem. It says, "Whose adorning, let it be not that outward adorning of the plaiting of the hair and of the wearing of gold or of the putting on of nice clothing. Let it be the hidden person of the heart, and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price." See, Peter's not saying here, "Oh, ladies, don't wear makeup. Ladies, you know, don't dress nice. You know, ladies, go cut out a piece of the carpet and put a hole in it and put it over your head." That's not what he's saying. What he's saying here is, let it not be about all that, because that's not where your beauty comes from. I have been married to my wife now for 18 years. We'll be celebrating 19 on July. I dated for 5 years. I fell in love with her the day I saw her. So I've known her for over 25 years. And every single day she gets more beautiful. Now the beauty that she has today is different than the beauty I had when I first met her. But the point is this, is that even though our bodies change and even though things change over time, and sometimes we have crises that come into our life that maybe we don't feel beautiful anymore. The reality is your beauty comes from the inside, and you are always beautiful. You're always beautiful because the Lord made you. Jacob fell in love with a woman that he was attracted to, but as we're going to find out as we go through the story, Leah was the better woman. And you tell me who you'd want to be. because in the end, Leah was the one who experienced the blessing of God. Well, we move down here, verse 18 of Genesis 29. Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. He makes it clear. I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Laban agrees. He goes, it's better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Abide with me. So the pact is settled. Jacob, where it mentions here that he loved her, this is the word for genuine love in the Hebrew, and it's seen in how the 7 years passed quickly because of how much he loved her. For it goes down here in verse 20, and Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love that he had to her. What a powerful thought. He really did care about this girl. He really did love her. And, to work 7 years, that would be the equivalent of a dowry price, but a very hefty one. That would not be the normal price, 7 years' wages. But remember all the gifts that were brought to his mother, Rebekah, 10 camels worth. And so Jacob, in his mind, he's thinking, I've got to do the same at least, or he won't accept. But Laban agrees to the price, knowing he's going to charge quite a bit more. I love it. It's interesting here in verse 20, and Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Turn over to Genesis 28, 43 through 45. I'm sorry, 27. 27. You're probably looking, my Bible doesn't have that many verses. 27. Verses 43 through 45. This is Rebekah's words of advice to her son. Now therefore, my son, this is after all the fallout of lying to his father and getting the blessing. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise and flee thou to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and tarry with him how long? How ironic. Same words he uses, and it seemed to him but a few days. Tarry with him a few days until your brother's fury turn away, until your brother's anger turn away from you and he forget that which you have done to him. And then I will send and fetch you from there. For why should I be deprived of both of you in one day? Jacob has to be thinking, the plan's working. The plan is working. I'm here for 7 years. I get a wonderful wife. Esau will chill out and soon I'll be back home with all the inheritance and all the blessing. Boy, is he wrong. Verse 21. And Jacob said unto Laban, give me my wife, or literally, hand over my wife. Give me the woman. That was all I cared about on my wedding day. I don't remember much of anything in my wedding day. I dated for 5 years. Hand over the woman. Hand over the woman, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her. And that means exactly what you think it means. It may have seemed like a few days, but after 7 years, he wasn't waiting one more. And so he says, I want to be with my wife. And Laban gathered together all the men of the place, and he made a feast. And it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, and he went in unto her. And Laban gave unto his daughter Leah, Zilpah, his maid, for a handmaid. So he throws the big wedding feast. Rachel's there for the wedding feast. But then as evening comes, or nighttime, and without our modern light pollution, it would have been considerably darker than our nighttimes. It says that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him. So the idea when they would go into the honeymoon suite, he brought Leah instead, and they would be veiled heavily, brought Leah, and they consummated the marriage. And it mentions here real quick in verse 24 that Laban gave unto his daughter Leah Zilpah, his maid, for handmaid. So he gave one of his maidservants to her to be her personal servant. And she's introduced because she'll figure into the story later on when her and Rachel are having a race to see who can have the most kids. Now the ultimate question I think we all ask, maybe it's just me, is how in the world did Jacob fall for this? All right. To this day, actually, the way the Jewish marriage feast worked in Jesus's day, I don't know if they still do it this day, but in Jesus's day, there would always be what they would call the rapture, which I can't get into all this tonight, but they would always be, they call it the rapture. And it was the idea he would go and he would steal his bride. He would come in and he would, the trumpets would blare and they would say, the bridegroom's coming, the bridegroom's coming. And the whole town would begin to awake for the wedding feast. But he would actually go into the bride's home and he would steal the bride and then take her to the wedding. And then they would, you know, say their vows and celebrate and consummate the marriage. But it was Jewish tradition when he would go in, there was never a theft. Dad was there, standing there, watching. All the bridesmaids were there with her. And the idea was, is all the witnesses were there to make sure the right girl went to the right guy. Dead serious. That's exactly how it went. To make sure no switcheroo was pulled. That all the groomsmen that were with him, they would go, yep, that's her. And all the bridesmaids would go, yep, that's her. And Dad would say, I'm giving you the right girl. And he would say, I'm taking the right girl. So there'd be none of this mess. But it wasn't around back then. In addition to that, gender customs were very different back then. There would be almost no interaction once the engagement was set. So during these 7 years, there was little to no interaction between Jacob and Rachel. So it's not like they became best buds. It's not like they knew each other. It's not like he knew the way that she moved or the way that she leaned on a chair. He didn't know any of those things. He would still not know her very well. And being completely veiled in the way that culture did things, it would be possible for him to sleep with a woman that he thought was someone else. And thus the morning revealed an interesting turn of events. Verse 25 says, and it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah. There is so much to reflect on in that phrase. Good whoa! You know, I mean, in that moment, can you imagine? Let's just start with Jacob. Can you imagine how Jacob felt when he realizes what his own uncle did to him? What happened the night before? Realizing she is no longer a virgin, I cannot just give her back. All of this is hitting him as he wakes up and behold, it was Leah. But what about Leah? There was no good morning for her. The first words she hears upon waking up are the angry words of the man she just deceitfully slept with. But what about Rachel? She gets to say all the vows at the wedding, but then she spends the night alone, all the while knowing that her sister is sleeping with her husband. There is no one who is left unscathed in this. There is only one person who comes out ahead, and it's Laban. And he's got Jacob right where he wants him. And so, in verse 25, he says to Laban, what is this you have done unto me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why have you beguiled me? A rare Hebrew word. The word goes deeper than deception. It means to betray someone in such a way that your close relationship is forever changed. Jacob, when he's saying this to him, he's going, how could you do this knowing that you and I could never look at each other the same after this has happened? Now, that's a question he should have asked himself when he forever altered his own family relationships. But he didn't. But see, Laban is a pragmatist, just like Jacob. It worked. It worked. And he has a plan to make it keep working. Verse 26. And Laban said, it's not my fault, Jacob. It must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. We can't do it that way. To marry Rachel, you've got to marry Leah too. And so I just sped the process up. Fulfill her week. Most marriage celebrations in those cultures lasted a week. And he says to him, listen, just show good form in front of everybody, Jacob. Honor Leah for a week, and here's what I'll do for you. We will give you this also for the service which you shall serve with me yet 7 other years. It's interesting. The phrase there, we will give thee, is the same exact words that Jacob said when he said, give me my wife. We will hand over your wife to you. You said, give me the wife. Well, we'll give her to you. But here's what you got to do. You got to work 7 years for her too. The same words that Jacob used when his 7 years were up, and how those words must have burned Jacob. He comes in, hand over my wife. And here's Laban, probably with a smile on his face. Oh, we'll hand over your wife. It's got to work another 7 years, buddy. It's just how we do it in this country. And what's Jacob going to do? He has no advocates. He's in a place where he's all alone. A place he's brought himself to by his own deception. It's a sad bit of irony that Jacob tried to reverse the birth order blessing by deception. But now he gets stuck with it here. I'm going to take the blessing even though I'm the younger. Well, now he's the one that's on the end of this. He has truly reaped exactly what he sowed. And so Jacob, verse 28, he did so. He agrees to work 7 more years for Rachel. And he fulfilled her week. That's Leah's. He did the marriage celebration, honored her for the week. And then Laban gave him Rachel, his daughter, to wife also. So Jacob didn't have to work the 7 years and then get Rachel. He got her after 7 days. And so it mentions that Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, Bilhah, his handmaid, to be her maid. And so again, she is introduced for the same reason that Zilpah was introduced earlier. It's because she's going to factor into the story later on. And we don't want to wonder where she all of a sudden came from. Verse 30, he went in unto Rachel, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 other years. Jacob, he loved her more than Leah, it says. Jacob thinks he has what he wants, but the truth is all he has is trouble. Instead of crying out to the Lord when this happened and saying, Lord, why did this happen and what do I do? He takes matters into his own hands again and he makes them worse. Fine, I'll take her as a wife, but I'm not going to love her like I love Rachel because Rachel's the one I wanted. What a mess. And if you thought his family situation growing up with the favoritism was a little messy, get ready for the most dysfunctional family of the millennium in the next few chapters. So anyway, the next set of verses 31 through 35, actually belong with chapter 30. We will begin to look at this dysfunctional family. The Osbournes got nothing on these guys. So I have one verse I want to close with, though. But if you turn to Isaiah chapter 40, you know, throughout all this, Jacob, he tries to control the situation. He tries to command the situation. Figures, I can find ways to finagle this for my benefit. But the reality is he's in control of nothing. And the thing that he considered to be his strength was a great weakness because it made him vulnerable to someone who was just more conniving, had more experienced, and planned better than he did. And so this is God's word here in Isaiah 40, verses 30 through 31 to us. Isaiah 40, verses 30 through 31. No matter how strong you are, Jacob, even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. The idea here is that even those who are in their prime, those who are at their very best, you're going to get wiped out. You're going to stumble. You're going to fall. You're not going to have what it takes in every given situation. So rather, verse 31, but they that wait upon the Lord. That word there, wait, it means to entwine yourself. They that entwine themselves in the Lord, that wrap themselves in the Lord, that entrust themselves to the Lord. It says they shall renew, or your Bible might say exchange, their strength. See, our strength comes from exchanging what we perceive to be our strength for the Lord's strength. Because our strength is really what? It's weakness. It's weak. At some point, in some scenario, it's weakness. So those that wait or entwine themselves in the Lord, they shall exchange their strength. And when you have the Lord's strength, look what happens. They are not going to faint and be weary and utterly fall, but they shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Amen? Let's entwine ourselves in the Lord and exchange our weakness, or what we perceive to be our strength, for His strength, that we might be able to overcome. So, amen.